Welcome to Founders Gone AI. Join us as we dive into our journeys as bootstrap founders navigating the world of AI-driven products. Let's get inspired, let's get informed, and if you're ready, let's get ahead.
There we go. Steve, good to see you, sir. It's been a long time.
Good to see you again. I was going to say the title of this episode should be like, "We are so back."
We are so back. I know. It's been so long. Wow, it's been a while. So those of you who are still tuning in, please keep tuning in. Thank you for keeping this followed on your podcast player. And maybe some of you are seeing this for the first time, and we are resuming what we started a little while ago. Mostly, I was just thinking the other day, wow, there's a lot of stuff we haven't talked about recently. There's just everything. You know, the only thing that's consistent about AI is that it's lightning fast.
Yeah, there's always stuff to talk about. Like, that's the...
Yes. And I'm in this entrepreneurial online WhatsApp group, and it's like the group has different topics, and one of them is the AI topic. So of course I joined like a year or so ago, and it's, I have to say, the other day I was like, you know, this is exhausting just being in this group. I feel taxed almost because there's just so much going on, and everyone's like, oh my gosh, you have to download this, you have to do this. And anyway, I thought, well, you know, I used to rely on Steve to give me some signals about what was important and what was not important to jump on every bandwagon. So I thought, well, you know, I should see if he wants to do a recording at least. And anyway, here we are. So I'm glad we're making this happen.
Yep, bringing it back. What are the... I guess, yeah, I mean, we can jump in. Like, what are the tools you're using today? Like, what is... Today?
You know, so I'm hearing left and right about Claude Code. I did download it the other day and sign up for a trial. And mostly co-work was what was most intriguing. I think everyone in the group was like, Claude Code, it's amazing. I still haven't gotten there where I'm amazed at Claude Code itself yet, because I just feel like it's comparable to a cursor or to a clean A client. I'm not sure what they call it. Visual Studio is sort of what I'm using with something called Clean A. I think it's called Clean A.
Yeah, I think it's like K-L-I-N-E.
Or C-L-I-N-E with maybe an accent E. I don't know. It's from the Bay Area, though, but it sounds like French. But it's basically the same thing as Cursor. You can just choose any model. The nice thing about it was that it was open source. You know, I'm sure Cursor is to some degree. But also it was it's just pay as you go. You don't have to use any kind of subscription. Now with Claude Code, the thing that intrigued me was the co-work feature. I don't know if you've been playing with that very much.
I was actually going to build some virtual machines to run. I was going to have it take over and build just a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And see what it did.
Yeah, that sounds like a good use case. I assume you have that?
Yeah, so I have kind of Claude Code, and then I have,
Codex. You were using Cursor last time I talked to you.
Yeah,
the
coolest part now is between Codex and Claude Code, I never leave my terminal. And so I'm back to using Vim, or I'm able to use, like, my normal editing.
Vim, wow.
So I can use Vim. I was gonna try to like work more with Emacs. Like I used to use Emacs a lot.
Oh gosh,
I'm back to it.
This is really becoming the Matrix, isn't it? It's back to the command line.
But like the coolest part now is, you know, in my I have a very extensive tmux setup that I've had probably for like 15 years, and so with that, like I have, you know, Claude Code's running, I have Codexes running, and then I have the max plans for both. So I have like OpenAI or ChatGPT, the Pro, and then I have the Claude Max, the Max 200, and I can run them things and just put them to work. And I force them into, like with GPT, right now I'm using GPT 5 or Codex 5.2 with the X High for reasoning. So it takes longer to get my answer, but everything that I ask and kind of everything we do is almost flawless.
Oh, what? Interesting.
And so that's like the beauty of it. It's just, it's working so well. And then, yeah, so actually the last kind of few weeks, I haven't even touched Claude Code just because Codex, really? Codex is so good. And I feel bad because it's like, it's almost like I have this FOMO. Everybody's like, oh, Claude Code is so great. It's really doing well. And then every time I get a little frustrated with Codex, I'll go to Claude Code. And it makes me appreciate how little I'm frustrated with Codex. And it's, yeah, so I mean.
Interesting. So this is, you're kind of blowing my mind again. This is why, I appreciate you, Steve, is that you're always a few steps ahead of most people I know. So you kind of dumped Claude Code for Codex.
Yeah, I, and to be fair, I will go back and forth between the two. I just have not had a reason to go back to Claude Code yet.
Interesting.
And I've tried it on a couple of things recently, and it's still not where I need it to be. I guess the other part is to, like, and to be fair for both, like, for Codex and Claude Code, like, I'm not giving them as much context as I could. So I'm doing some things with, okay, you know, different things in a certain version of Kubernetes with Go, and I need kind of help constructing certain things. And in those cases, the documentation isn't great online, so it's not trained on it. So what I should be doing is building up a skill in Claude, or, you know, building up some context where I have all of this, and then I'm sure Claude would do better. But the other part, though, is, like, I don't have to do all that to get Codex to just do it. And so that's kind of where I've been.
So that's kind of cool. So basically, yeah, because everyone's like, oh my gosh, skills are incredible. It's like, well, yes, they could be incredible if you're willing to put in the time and energy to make them incredible for you. So you're saying that you're getting pretty much what you think are similar results just from Codex by default.
And I haven't tried the skill, so I don't actually know.
Yeah.
And then, just as we're talking about this, and I was talking about this with somebody last night or yesterday, last night, a headline comes out from Vercel that skills are, or like agents MD outperform skills.
Oh.
It's like, what? Yeah. What? I mean, realistically, it is all just kind of prompts.
The same.
So that maybe makes
sense. Yeah. Just different ways of prompting. It's like different ways of slicing this this deli meat.
Yeah. So I've been really impressed with Codex.
Okay, cool.
Comes more. I think Claude,
it's not even known as a coding, you know, ChatGPT is not typically known as a coding tool amongst the world. I don't know, you know, but I am curious. I mean, you're finding it totally acceptable. I, you know, honestly, my only experience with ChatGPT as a model coding was a little bit after, I think they released 5. And Sam Altman talked about how great the new coding features were, and I tried it in maybe Cursor or something like that, and I was like, yeah, you know, it's interesting. Just I didn't maybe give it enough of breathing room to really show me what it could do. And I think it was before even 5.2, so maybe that's even better now.
Yeah, I was not impressed kind of when it first came out, because I tried doing what they did in their demos, where they said, like, build me a website, do all this stuff, and clearly, Vercel dominated that whole thing. And so they couldn't do it as good as Vercel. And then I couldn't even get it to kind of go into the mode where it said it would. Like, I had to, like, keep arguing with it. Like, no, you can do this. And it's like, oh, you're right, I can generate an image. Oh, okay. And so it was just, like, really weird. And then even the difference, like, the other day, so I saw 5.2. So there's Codex 5.2 Max model.
Oh.
I don't have access to it, but in my Codex CLI, I saw, like, I had Max, and I selected it. And then all of a sudden I'm getting, like, this crappy output. I'm like, why does this suck so bad? And then I realized it was 5.1 Max, not 5.2 Max. So I'm not even using 5.2 Max. I'm using 5.2 not Max with XPI reasoning. And I'm getting much better than just, like, the 5.1 Max.
Wow. So
the system, like, really, I don't know, it's really interesting things. And I guess I'm, like, using C and Python and TypeScript.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's wild. Okay. That's cool. It's definitely a, I guess, you know, that I think about it, there are some folks that I know that are being made fun of for using the command line because they're being made fun of by non-coders, I think. And that's kind of interesting. Are you, so just in that world, there's people now that I'm seeing in this group who I know well, you know, I know outside of this group, and I know they were never coders. They were like, that was never their business. That was never their thing. At best, they were a little, you know, pro Notion users or something like that.
Right.
Now they're coding apps. And they're like, oh my gosh, I feel like Perseus or something. Are you finding a lot of people in your organization or just in your world that are like suddenly becoming coders?
And we're seeing that. Yeah, I mean, just in general, there's the harder part, I think, starting to understand is, one, there's like a lot of best practices that are now kind of being thrown out the window. So that's where you'll see like Mongo repos, where it used to be back in the day, code had to be read by humans and interpreted by humans. So you had to like write it very efficiently. You wouldn't put multiple projects together in all of these things. But now it's actually more important to do that. The other side to it is some apps, especially when you start thinking about, I can build a web app, sure, but now when I deploy that, it's not scaling, or how do I like do this or do that? So there's a part where at some point you have to figure out kind of like what is the right architecture for this, and then understand like how to deploy this. So it's like taking the vibe coded thing to prod. Right? Mm. I think the key piece is how do you get it into production? Right? Wow. How do you get to where, and at the same time, like even in production, how are you accurately testing that if you're not a coder, right? If you don't understand like what you're seeing, because there's still, it's not often, but there's still a lot of times where like when code is generated, you're like, no, that's not right. Do this instead. Or even just ask, like, why did you do this? And I'll say like, oh, I did it because of this. And you're like, well, that's maybe we're not doing it that way. So you can, but you just need to be able to like sometimes have those conversations, because especially in really, really sensitive areas, right? When you think about like authentication and like the authorization, like those pieces are very, I would almost argue like a very important to get right. You can get them wrong, but you will lose trust really fast. Right. And so like, if you want people to use your stuff, they have to be able to trust it. And I think that's what's, I don't know that it's happened yet, but I think like, I mean, you've seen on X sometimes where somebody's like, hey, I'm seeing like all of these, you know, like weird requests to my database and all this other stuff. And it's because, they've vibe coded and somehow they had their .env not in a gitignore and they pushed it up to GitHub, or they're putting stuff in the front end. Like the front end is hitting some API with an API key embedded in it. And so there's just like a lot of stuff that non-coders may not get, but will really...
they don't understand the concepts. Back end, front end. These are things that mean nothing to them usually.
Yeah, they're trusting the LLM too much. And even in a lot of cases from a, like just doing stuff from a Unixy perspective, when something isn't working, its first answer a lot of cases is, well, just chmod 777. So make it like re-execute by anybody.
Oh, yeah, of course. Overwrite.
Like it gets really crazy just in its guessing. And so that's the key, is like you have to be able to understand like that's a no, like we will get roasted if we do this.
Or... Well, yeah, good point. And, you know, if you think about the Stack Overflow archive that it grabbed a lot of its knowledge from, because it didn't just think of this itself, you had people throwing out, hey, I just did this. What do you, you know, is this a good idea or wasn't it, what's going on? And then people would say, don't do that, you idiot. Here's the right way. Now, we don't know whether it's intelligent enough to thoughtfully and carefully read through each thread when it was trained, or whether it just grabbed bits and pieces and had to, okay, we got to compress this into a small enough file. And so it's grabbing some things that are bad practice and some things that are good practice.
Like there's been issues where it's making a decision, and like I've been Googling and I find all these Stack Overflow posts, and the Stack Overflow post is like, it works, but it's a really bad idea. And it's got like really high Everybody loves it. It solved the problem.
Got it.
Okay. It is a terrible, terrible thing to do. You should never do this. But somehow, because everybody in Stack Overflow loves it, now I've kind of been weighted as this
there
is
you a go.
Answer. You that should makes do sense. That. And that's what, yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's the.
Yeah, your example is actually probably perfect on there because it. If you have the carefulness and the thoughtfulness and the slowness of a human, you might read through the whole thing before you made that decision to push it into, you know, oh, I'm going to use this for my company. But, you know, as somebody who used to do this, I used to go on Stack Overflow, grab, you know, whatever was my problem at the moment. Okay, let me try this. Let me paste that in there. That's kind of what it's doing at lightning speed.
Yeah, without the ability for you to read down the comments. Yeah. And say somebody who's calling out, like, what about this? You guys.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then because it's somebody called somebody dumb, it's all downvoted and nobody
asked before. Right. No, that's a very good point. And I think the other thing that occurs to me is, with coding at least, is that people are feeling such FOMO emotionally. In the developer world, that they don't have, and you know, either that's because they're building an app and they're like, I gotta beat everybody else out. And you know, before you had 6 months to a year runway to kind of like, you know, the race was 6 months to a year to get to an MVP. Right. So I have some time and let me make it good. And now no one has time. You know, if I don't get this out by tomorrow or the next week, my competitor will have the full version out and I've got to beat them to market. So that's a huge amount of FOMO. You don't have time to really wonder at that moment, is this, you know, is this safe? Is this secure? I just have to trust that GPT will know.
Yeah. And I think that is the hard part. And at the same time though, you have to also think through, is your competitor doing the same thing? But also like, this is the tricky part. Like there's, I think actually, this was something, there was the Every podcast with Andrew Wilkinson, like a few days ago. Like one of the things that he said was when people, you know, if let's say you build a machine to make like the world's best pizza and you can sell that for $10,000 and everybody can have one in their home, like it's not going to get rid of pizza restaurants, right? You're not going to stop going out to that pizza. It's just going to be better for the consumer. So there may be, you're going to have competitors, you might have more competitors, but again, it's just that differentiation where now people are more buying you as opposed to buying maybe your competitor or whatnot. Right. So it's almost like I think the micro SaaS is like the perfect, it's the perfect time, right? Cause think about just getting, you know, having maybe, and this is where a lot of times like diversity might actually win out instead of like that long-term focus. Because if you can churn out an MVP that can start trying to get revenue or even get hits in a weekend, the amount of those you can do really quick and just to see like if you can start monetizing,
it'd
be like way more than if you go hardcore into this one thing. And you can still go hardcore into one thing, but I think the ability to like test, throw out MVPs really fast is probably important. And then, you know, you'll be able to see kind of where the market is, but then at the same time, once you start getting traction, competitors will also come in. And so just being able to have kind of those.
Yeah. The moat is not very deep anymore. It's a very good point. And thankfully the one protection one has at the moment is it's still human generated. It's still human initiated.
You
don't have yet some crazy all-powerful model that is instructed to just build everything else on the market and, you know.
Yeah, everything.
exactly. Which may come in about 3 months, but for now it's still like, oh, I have an idea for an app. Now I can build this app within a weekend. Let me get pushed out the door. The other thing too, of course, is that it's all part of this general category of AI slop where just because you can make something doesn't mean it's going to be successful or adopted. And especially if that person is one of 100 new apps that comes out, and they don't, and then they're on to the next shiny object. That itself can destroy your own app and success, because you're like, I literally know a guy in my town who's never built an app before. And then about, I think it was about 4 months ago, he was maybe 5 months ago, he was like, oh, I'm gonna build an app. And I was like, cool. So he built the app in Cursor. It's an iOS app. It was really cool. We celebrated kind of a little miniature like launch with him, you know, at a coffee shop. And within a week and a half, he was on to the next project. And I was like, well, what happened to the other one? He's like, oh, yeah, I don't know. This new one is more exciting. I think this one's going to succeed. So he built that one. 2 months later, that one was done. Now he's got two apps. And he launched the second one. He was excited about it. He got no downloads and realized the other one was at least getting some downloads. And now he's switching back to the other one, but he's also looking at a new one. And so you have kind of this weird dynamic where, and I don't blame him. I mean, I think it's so powerful and exciting that you're kind of like you want to chase every fire truck. And yet, as we know, launching is an app is much more than just the technology, you know?
And I think that's the thing about having the audience, having the brand, right? Like having people kind of even just who resonate like with your vision or like with your philosophies. Like, I think that's going to be way more important than sometimes even the app.
Yeah.
Because and especially if they know, like when you're starting to build like these smaller apps or you have a smaller customer base, like let's say you're taking a feature that Salesforce doesn't have. And so you're making a little thing off to the side that's maybe going to have 20, 30, 100 users. You can then answer questions from those users. They can call you. There's all of this stuff where you can have a much more intimate relationship with your customer, and at the same time have a much more kind of tighter idea on those features. And really, I think there's like the 1,000 true fans thing. I don't know what the equivalent would be for a X true subscribers, right? Or like whatever. Because if you have 10 subscribers and it's, you know, something that's like $100 a month, a couple $100 a month, you don't
that
need to
work
doing that, right? I mean,
if they were going to pay that much, that's the other concern though, is would they pay $100 in a day when there could be 10 competitors even for that product now?
Yeah. And I think that's where it comes down to the brand, right? And if they know, they can talk to you and you'll listen to them or you'll even help them, right? Yeah. Like how you should set this up, whatever. Like a lot of those people at $100 isn't that big of a deal.
Right.
And so they're thinking it's not just, they're not just getting the app, they're getting you, they're getting somebody who listens to them and understands kind of their problem. And so I think there's a realness to the human element of a lot of this, especially now in AI where all these things are just, you get responded to by a bot. Call somebody or like you get an email and they use ChatGPT to send it. Right. So there's like all of this stuff that's not original or just feels AI sloppy.
It's a fake experience to some degree. It's plastic, I guess I would kind of say.
Yeah. Like, and I think that's the key now having that human element. Like I actually get frustrated when people send me, if I ask them a question and they send me something that ChatGPT said, I didn't ask that. Right. And
just pasted it in.
Yeah. And I actually don't like that's, I intentionally like take the time to personally like think through like what I'm talking about or what I'm trying to say. Like I want to be genuine in my response. I mean, maybe there's times where it doesn't matter. Like,
sure.
But for the most part, like being genuine, I think is like it's going to be rare. Right.
Yeah. Valuable.
To generate all that. And I even think the podcast apps, right? Like everybody, like for the last, I don't know, however long, like 20 years has been trying to make the perfect sounding episode. Don't say, don't have likes and make the perfect copy. Like all of these things that AI will do just way better than you.
Yes.
But then you're not trying to be like as good as the AI. And so I think being original now would be more, I guess, advantageous as opposed to trying to remove all your filler words or trying to make it sound like you're perfect when you're not, right?
Totally.
You're real. And so
yeah. That's a good point. I think I just saw an interview on Reels, I guess, with Jensen Huang, and they said, who's the most intelligent person you know? He really wouldn't even answer the question. He just said, honestly, the traditional idea of intelligence is now a commodity. And I think the same thing is true. What you're saying is that the perfection that we were shooting for before AI is now a commodity. It's very easy to attain. You don't have to work very hard now. In fact, it's easier to get the perfect version because it requires no human effort. Yeah. And now it's harder to get the imperfect version because you can tell it did require effort. And so if you're thinking about art, much easier to get the AI generated one versus the one where it has some, you know, imperfections, a painting that's actually, you know, real.
Yeah.
And podcast too. So that'll be a reality for us in many ways.
Yeah. I think that's kind of the era of genuineness and like real, because again, like to build real connection when you find out that somebody has trained their voice.
Yeah.
In 11 labs, and then they've now went through and asked ChatGPT to give them transcripts of what they should talk about, and they give that transcript to 11 labs. 11 labs generates a podcast with their voice, and then they upload it. Right? That's
annoying. I mean, it's fun. It's cool. It is cool. I think this is where I always come to, which is like, that's neat that it can be done. Do I want to spend my time listening to a robot yak all day? And this is what I find when I'm as a consumer on YouTube, is I still go to the human generated videos. There are a few topics that I'm willing to listen to an AI lecture me, but because I've never heard anyone really talk about that topic before.
Right.
And it's, you know, there was one that I don't know how I ended up on this, but it was like, how to survive in your car if you're homeless. And I'm like, what a weird channel. Of course, there's tons of videos from this channel and are all pretty much the same. And there's these videos, these little clips of homeless people sleeping in their car. And I was like, you know, it's freezing out. It's cold. And I'm like, you know, I got stuck about 6 months ago or maybe a year ago now on the side of the highway where I am in a rural area at night. It was a chilly night, around 40 degrees. And within about 2 hours, I was like freezing. I had a nice jacket on. I had all this stuff. And I was like, why was I so cold? I had the car. And from this one video, I learned, oh, it's because I was losing all my heat through the windows. And if you just, you know, block your windows, you'll be able to retain all this heat. Oh, wow. That's very helpful. Good knowledge I never knew. But other than that, I don't want to listen to it, you know, even that one video I noticed about halfway through started to repeat itself with the same information, which I thought was interesting. And what I'm finding too is like any of the AI generated videos, sometimes they will repeat themselves. Sometimes there's one history podcast I tried to listen to where it was talking about the Vikings and how the Vikings this and that. It was kind of like history, blah, 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 faithless. And then halfway through, maybe an hour in, because it's a long podcast, I wake up and I'm listening to it, and it's talking about ancient China, but the title's still the Vikings. The video hasn't changed at all, and the AI just started talking about China, and the creator had no idea. I was probably one of the, you know, I'm actually happen to be listening to it. And so it's just like, who's watching all this? Like, who's doing quality control when you're asking 11 labs to do all of your content for you, you know?
Yeah, that's the other hard part too, right? Is you're not listening to it.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of times, especially if you're gonna make like an hour long or a Joe Rogan or Lex Friedman kind of podcast, good luck going exactly. through. And even then, like a lot of times the stuff will contradict itself. Right? So it'll say one thing and then it'll say another thing. And then it'll even go back to then contradicting what it just contradicted.
Yeah, exactly.
It does get weird.
I mean, it could be corrected with an engineering, you know, approach, I'm sure. And it will, I'm sure at one point it might get there. But the question that I, you know, was I watching like one of the famous AI, you know, developers, brilliant minds, was just talking about Yeah, he was talking about like an interview, like why what we're noticing is that when he's like in Cursor, you will fix one problem and say, fix this issue, there's a bug here. And it will say, of course, let me get on that, it will fix it for you. And then it'll introduce like three new bugs. And we're trying to figure out what that is. And so even if you were able to figure out what is causing some of these little glitches I'm talking about, and someone addresses it at one of these large AI companies, is it an engineering problem only? Is it just like a little polishing here and there, or is there a deeper problem with it? Not when we begin to let go of when the creator stops looking at their creation and just lets it run, lets the machine run, is there just a natural atrophy that occurs where it stops focusing on what you told it to originally and no one's there to correct it? You know, that would be my philosophical question.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see that a lot too, especially the challenge right now, because everybody, or there seems to be like a lot of, it's like every year, for like the last few years now, like the last couple of years, ever since RAG came out, the concept of is RAG dead? it just repeats itself.
Funny.
And it ends up being that you can have these really large context windows, but they still lose signal. Mm. They still lose signal pretty fast. And so at the same time, even having those context windows, one, they're losing signal, but there's this level of recursion that you just have to start going through, right? I asked it this question. What are the steps to answering that? And then working through that and having something else verify each time. But then you can't always count to that verification. Like, was it successful? So then you have to have a verifier verify the verifier. Yeah. And then you do that at some count, right? And the other part is doing that, you're asking an LLM, which takes tokens, and you're feeding in all of this other context, right? So you're kind of flooding the context or putting other context around it that's not, maybe not perfectly accurate, or you're just giving it other stuff. And so you're filling this window. And yeah, at some level, like you have to just keep reiterating or trying to break it down to the smallest thing and then taking those very small units, putting them together, and then seeing if that still makes sense. But it costs tons of time, lots of power, money for token generation. So like there's got to be the balances that the state of the art.
I was just watching, that's one of the video titles I saw last night was Is RAG Dead? And I thought, oh, I hadn't seen that before. So that's funny that you mentioned that. And you're right. I think in some ways what I've kind of come to is that, at least right now, it still benefits from structure. And I think, we had that guy on the podcast, one of our previous episodes. Can't remember his name. Bad of me not to remember his name, but he was smart guy. Yeah, there you go. And he was mentioning, I think what I gained from him was like AI really benefits from very clear, concise structure with code.
Yeah, and like especially type definitions, right? So like type language, type structure. Like that's kind of his focus was, if you say this thing is going to be an int or an array of characters, like that is it, right? It's very easy then to, one, get your response back, validate it in code, but also the LLM can kind of validate, hey, is this valid or whatever, right? So there is.
Yeah, and so as long as maybe the general, again, theoretical problem to me is that because we want our cake and we want to eat it too, we want accuracy and precision, maybe the right term is accuracy, I don't know, but we also want I think the right term would be accuracy. We want accuracy. It's probably better at precision in some ways, but it may be in the wrong complete it may be precise about the wrong answer, whereas we actually want the right answer. We want accuracy. And so we want these things that are extraordinarily variable. They're extraordinarily dynamic. They can answer any you can ask in a coding prompt in Cursor or in Codex, you can ask a question about politics and get an answer. Why can you do that? I mean, because these LLMs are so variable, they can talk about anything. And so how can you get this amazing accuracy and consistency and lack of hallucinations when at the same time this thing is supposed to be so dynamic. I don't know.
That's where you're seeing a lot of these models that are trained specifically for kind of a purpose, right? So there's coding models, there's models for, you know, specific elements of vision for like even, you know, auto repair or auto analysis of certain things, right? So like, I think that's the key, is like training models,
finding
them on very specific data sets and then forcing them to lean towards that.
Got it.
You can even, in a lot of cases, you still have to have like a, I hate the term guardrails because I think it's like the word agent, but kind of this concept where you have to be able to have some structure around what is being asked, or even some kind of some enforcement. Because if you have a something that's a vision model that's meant to like tell you if your car has hail damage, and you get some political question or who has the best pizza or whatever, right? Like there's this question that's not going to be good at, and trying to use that without some boundaries there. Like, hey, I was only trained to talk about car stuff. So if you're asking me this, it's not.
Which may be good. I mean, it may be what humans have to realize that they need to endure to get better results is stop asking, you know, keep it focused on what you've paid for, what you've selected for in this moment. That's fascinating. And maybe that's where you're saying like the one you're using, Codex, is pretty well cleaned out of a lot of the general stuff, right?
Oh, I don't know I don't actually know. Like I guess I could ask it, like, hey, who's got the best French fries in town? But
I don't know. Might have to know that. I mean, so yeah, but some coders might need that in their,
One of the other concepts, and I think, so this was from Boris, the creator of Claude Code. He talks about there's this concept of reverse solicitation, where the model is learning to ask you questions.
All right.
You say, who has the best French fries in town? It'll say, oh, what town are you in? Yeah. What kind of fries do you like? Do you want crinkle cut? Do you like whatever sweet potato? I don't know, whatever kind of French fries they make. So it could be something like that, where it then knows like these other questions to follow up with. But then knowing when to reverse solicit versus to just say like, what is a French fry? Like there's different things there. Right. So I don't know how they do it, but I think, and the other side of this too, is like, we're talking about all these, they're just problems because something is new. So we don't know how to use all this stuff. Right. And a lot of times people don't actually even know like how it works. And so we're doing all these things. We're playing with this new technology, but think about 5 years from now, 10 years from now, are we going to have like, how's it going to work? Is it just going to be, we'll go to ChatGPT, we'll ask a question. There will be some, and I think there already is a router in place that determines like, what do you want to know? What is that? Does that go to this custom model, that custom model, like these things, do I need to take 10 different models and combine them to give you this answer? The question is, do we as humans, like even right now, if you want to go to, you know, let's say you wanted to take a road trip to my house. I want to take a road trip to your house. I'm just going to put it in my phone, right? And I'm going to follow, right? So I'm just going to trust that versus I'm not going to figure out, okay, which way is north? All right. And then like get a map and then like figure that all out, right? So how do you?
And yet in the 90s, that would have been exactly what you would have done.
Exactly. Right. Or I'm lost a whole bunch. So now I'm like looking at, I need to know where is the sun. I need to know where is north.
My mom used to have a car in the probably made in the 90s or early 2000s that had a compass in there. I think some of them still do. Just thinking how why does my newer car not have a compass? I think it was just a waste of money for them to spend the dough. Everyone has, you know, smartphones.
I think in my console there is like a compass that says like what direction I'm heading.
With the map and stuff. Yeah.
So if it breaks down, battery's dead. Like,
not gonna help you.
I don't know.
It's a really good point. Is what does this all look like in 10 years? And I think it's hard for the human mind to, you know, especially at the speed these days, it's hard to wrap yourself like how much better could it be? It's just like it's going so fast. It's so smart already. What could it possibly look like in 10 years? That would be a massive exponential breakthrough.
I've heard we think, because like we think linearly, we don't think exponentially.
Yeah.
And so even whatever we're thinking, even if we try to think exponentially, it is just so far beyond what
you
can even imagine. And so I think Elon is always kind of freaking out about that, like the exponential, like we can't even think about
it. We can't even think about it,
And like all the other researchers, it's exponential. Like our minds are looking kind of for this linear, like even cosmic thing. And that's not how it works anymore.
Yeah, and at the same time, I almost wonder if we're also looking in the wrong direction. Like, we keep thinking, you know, let's say you imagine you were 1999, which I can remember because I was there. And I remember my friend, who was a much, much bigger nerd, showed me, I don't know, maybe Red Hat Linux or something for the first time. And I'm used to the Windows world, maybe a little Mac. He's showing me this incredible desktop for the first time, and he's showing me like windows that are translucent. And I'm like, oh my god, it's blowing my mind.
Was it enlightenment?
It was like an enlightenment. It was that's right. It was enlightenment. They're right. Actually, it was. And he's like, this is the future of computing. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. Now, you know, fast forward 10 years, there had been a change in Linux. This is him showing me Linux. But was it the change I was expecting? Did Linux take off and become the next Windows? And was the whole world using it? And we were all using really, really cool desktops. Yeah, some people were. But who cares? Like no one. Ubuntu kind of came out. Some people adopted that. It was somewhat successful, but it wasn't like it didn't change the world. Where it changed the world was in the server space, and basically replacing a bunch of Windows servers with Linux servers, and became ubiquitous in that world. And you could start up a gazillion of them on, you know, in a virtual setting, which no one was thinking about at the time. So I think the direction of it changed in the area of expansion changed. And what, interestingly enough, the stuff that I was looking at kind of just stayed a little static. So it's very possible that because we've done so good of a job at this point with LLMs being so smart, and there's such little information to harvest now, that the innovation isn't so much that these get exponentially better. Maybe they kind of cap out. Maybe the innovations happen on what they're applied to in different areas that we're not even really thinking of right now. And coding just kind of like peaks out, and it kind of, you know, it does get better, but it's not like hockey stick. It's like plateau.
And I think the fields, and this is talked about, I think, a lot, where what it comes down to, like, what is correct, right? So if I say who has the best pizza, that's not, you can't measure that, right? You can't write a unit test to verify and to see, like, okay, you said Pizza Hut.
Right.
No. And so there's like all these other variables that go into like, what is the best pizza? Like, who are you? What do you like? All those things versus what is, you know, 1 + 1, or how do I write a for loop? Right. Mm-hmm. Those are things that you can test. They're well documented. And so you can verify, right? So it's about the things that can be validated, but then it's still, even from the coding perspective, right, you can have it, like you can fix a bug, but it'll create others because it's not aware of what's going on elsewhere. Or in a lot of projects, everybody kind of has their own different styles, right? Mm-hmm. So one project could have this style, one project could have that style. And instead, it's just going to do like random things like that it thinks are good for that project. So it's not going to like adhere to a style in most cases. There's a concept called spec-driven development that tries to create that. And I think the Agents MD, Claude MD, like those things, you try to define your spec and you have hooks to validate, okay, did you meet these things? You know, you run your linters, whatever, to see like, did it follow this? But I think the big thing is having something that's verifiable. Code can be verified in most cases. Does it compile? Okay, that's first. Does it run, or based on this unit test, does it work? And I think that's the key there is, for stuff like code, it's pretty easy. But even then, like, what is good code? What is bad code?
Yeah.
Still the subjective part. So you can't measure, like, okay, it created this really cool vibe code app. Like, all these things work, but the code sucks. Or, I don't know, this leads to, like, the other thing is, I guess back in the day, people would write assembly, and I guess you would use these punch cards.
Right.
And you know, compilers came around and they're like, who's gonna use you punks using C? And right. It just turns into this thing like, oh, look at this crappy assembly the compiler generated. Almost coming to now, look at this crappy code the LLM generated. Well,
yeah.
Does it run? Does it pass the test? Is it secure?
Exactly. That's a very good point. And I keep seeing these folks that are old timers and they're like, oh, you know, we thought this was going to make such a big difference. The truth is that it's not making a difference. And I saw the guy last night, like, you know, young coders who are vibe coding are not productive at all. They're not really making anything. And I was like, actually, that's not my experience. They're making some stuff. I mean, they're making impressive stuff, actually. And, you know, I just didn't buy it. I was like, you know, yes, there's inefficiencies. And yes, vibe coding doesn't lead to a beautiful, perfect code base. But even, you know, I've literally developed apps so far that I built in Cursor about 6 months ago. And and people are using them. People are like, oh, this is great. Thank you. I'm using them. Other people are using them. I hired a developer recently to kind of keep someone because I didn't have the time to even look at the thing. So I just need a human in the mix, like looking at it and telling the thing to add features. He was a real developer though. And he was like, who made this product? And I was like, oh, well, you know,
I found it online.
Yeah. I kind of didn't answer the question, but he's like, there's JavaScript, you know, calls here. There's JS calls to PHP functions that don't exist. So someone had the idea to make something, but he never finished the implementation of it. Who did this? And I was like,
maybe that's a good question. That's ready. I want to remind myself.
But exactly.
And this is really the weird part to like the code that we're thinking of, like when we're looking at code, like it's for humans.
Yeah.
Right. So right now though, like LLMs are generating code for LLMs. And so we no longer look at assembly, right? Like aside from maybe like a stack trace, or if I'm like digging into like some like weird device driver issue, like it is very rare that I will touch assembly. Like I haven't had to use like inline assembly in C for at least 15 years. And so like nobody cares about assembly anymore. You do the same, it works, right? Yeah. You just assume like whatever's compiling, like all like GCC is doing it right or Clang's doing it right. And you just assume those things. And now I think the same thing's going to start coming around for whatever these higher level languages, like Python. What's that? And maybe even thinking about it differently, LLMs, like they're trying to be forced to use these languages that were designed for humans. So what about a programming language that was designed for LLMs?
Yeah, good point.
To consume correctly to do the same things we're doing, but because at the end of the day, it all does consolidate down to assembly to code and run on the CPU. So it's just at what level are we looking at? And we're blaming LLMs for trying to generate stuff that like only we should be able to understand, but LLMs don't need to understand the code. We need to understand it so they can.
But would it be a amalgamation of their own new, you know, maybe the best of human languages and pure assembly, or would it just be a brand new language, you think?
I think it has to be so everything in LLMs a lot of times is kind of in these embedded chunks, or they're like called morphemes. It's like the smallest part of a token. And so like with that, I think the LLMs would have to build like some language understand, because then the LLMs are optimized for themselves. Right, we're trying to make an LLM use what we know how to see. So when we see somebody do this in Python or this in C or whatever, like that's terrible. But that's terrible if we're looking at it or like, holy crap, you have a 7 meg file to do something. But again, that's so there's some things that like we're just used to as humans. We have such small brains, we can't fathom like this entire 7 megabyte context window that an LLM is like, oh, this is nothing. I know exactly what this is doing. I know all these, this is the best way to do it.
Right.
Dude, that is terrible. Like, look at how much stuff. Right? I just asked you to print a line and you now have like all of this supporting stuff to make sure what you're printing is actually terminal type, and you verify like all these other things. Like, cool, but irrelevant.
Inefficient.
like something like, I think even as humans, we might do some of those pieces if we thought they were valuable, but we also have the judgment to know that this is just like a quick thing I'm using that I'm going to throw away.
Got it.
And I'm trying to parse a file that I'm never going to parse.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about a comment, a comment is really there because we don't want to take the brain power to kind of review function and see what it is. Whereas an LLM, it wouldn't take that much to look at it and figure it out.
Well, and that's noise in the LLM, and worse, the comment. So one of the, all the good developers I know tell me the code is the comment itself. So
yeah,
the thing we have to think about, because there's a lot of times too, you're reading code, you're like, wait, the comment says it does this.
Right. But you're not seeing that. Yeah, true. And
so when it changes, then you're actually giving the LLM bad data.
True.
It's a note, right? Is it going to take the comment that says here's what it does? Or is it going to take the code?
That's interesting. That
is what it really does.
Right.
Or is it going to then take that comment and say, okay, the code does this, and now associate this block of code with actually doing that thing?
Yeah.
So you're setting it up for... You're setting up for failure.
For a bug, at least.
Yeah, and so I think those are some of the things, like, we might start seeing, we might start having to figure out, like, how do you, you know, we're trying to, like, morph LLMs to do, like, what we care about, but what if we morph, like, what we care about for the
right. LLM? I mean, eventually, you're right. We are, it's inevitably going to have to go to a world in which it's writing its own code, and it just looks like complete gibberish to us.
Yeah.
And I think we are, to some degree, comfortable with that because, I don't know, I think that's probably just the nature of how computers are. I hope that we don't lose it completely. I hope we don't lose at least the cipher or the ability to decrypt it. Like, we should at least have tools that can decrypt it, or at least other LLMs that can decrypt it for us that are non-partial, because that's where we get into trouble. But
You need to verify.
Right.
You need to have that trust, right? Especially if you're deploying something. I mean, imagine if you're a bank and you're building a banking app, right? For all of your customers to manage their money, potentially send money to other accounts, right? That's one, that's going to be under a ton of scrutiny, regulatory controls. But also, like, even if you get that path and it goes, like, and you send out something that's terrible, all the customers lose their money. Like, not going to be good, right? So you have to know, there have to be, like, all of these other safeguards in place to know, like, what you're doing isn't harmful, isn't, you know, malicious. Right. And then even worse, like, somebody trains a bad LLM to kind of, like, insert these random things. Or they just find it on Stack Overflow and, you know, they just insert it naturally. Right? Like, so there's all of this stuff that has to be figured out. But at the same time, like, I think, you just got to get started, right?
And humans in the loop somehow. Humans in the loop. Well, I'm looking at you and you're kind of becoming holy with this the sun right above your head.
Oh, yeah, I need to move my desk.
And maybe this is a good time. The sun is clearly out. I know you have family to orchestrate, as do I, today. So maybe this is a good time to put a cap on it at the end of the hour. And we can resume this chat in a few weeks. Any kind of quick updates related to any of your business ventures?
I've been able to do, like, a ton of migrations. I guess I'll say, like, migrating different platforms. Like, I was doing some interesting database stuff. I've now, like, built a consolidated database layer. Like, there's some really cool stuff. And then, I mean, just for, like, some of my fall time job stuff, like, I've been building. Like, I've just been able to, like, build a ton of things. So it's been...
We'll get into them. Maybe we can get into them next time and hear kind of, like, some of your projects, both internal, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
At work and outside of work.
Absolutely.
Cool. All right, sir. Well, good chatting with you. And maybe until next time.
Yep. Take it easy, Kevin.
All right. Sounds good. You too.